I'm very pleased to be here. A lot of what I'm going to talk about today deals with, I interview a lot of filmmakers and would-be filmmakers, and I find that talking to the people who make the films is much more important than talking to the critics. And most critics don't know much more about films than you do. They've just seen more and talked to each other. Very often, I really don't know how that film was made, and I really don't know why. And when you find out why it was made and how it was made, it really does illuminate. Okay, Hollywood's impact on our culture. Hollywood has never been bashful about saying what it is. It says we're an entertainment business. So they're a business and they're entertainment, and they don't have pretenses to being something else. Occasionally the business becomes an art. Occasionally you can make money from good films as well as bad films. But there's not much pretension in Hollywood. When we talk about Hollywood, Hollywood isn't just Hollywood in the sense there are more than one Hollywoods. So let's talk about two Hollywoods right now. The first is the Hollywood of the studio era, 1930 to the 1950s. And that's when the moguls ran things, the Warners and the Samuel Goldwyns and so forth. And each studio was a factory. It really was a dream factory. And the directors and the actors and so forth were employees of this corporation. And what's important for our topic is, what did Jack Warner think he was doing? Well, he thought he was going to make some money. And how's he going to make some money? He's going to make films for everybody. And the studio system said, we want everybody to come to the movies, which means teenagers through seniors. And they determined that women chose which films to go to. So when they started picking a story or going to their scriptwriters, they said, be sure that this film will appeal to women, because women are going to choose the film. But the women are going to drag their husbands and their boyfriends and their children, so have something good in there for the men too. So before they even began the film, that's what they had in mind. They want everybody to come, and they want women to choose, and they want men to be happy too. And they don't want to offend anybody, because that lessens the audience. So they had their own code of what language you could use and that you could not use negative ethnic stereotypes. There was a short period when they had a lot of, if you see movies between 1930 and 1934, before the code came in, they had all kinds of racial slurs and ethnic slurs and jokes. You know, I'll give you an anti-Semitic joke, or it's not a big one. They were talking about a horse race, and the guy said, well, the Jewish horse won. So what do you mean? He won by a nose. And there was stuff like that in the movies, and they said, let's get rid of all that. And so they got rid of all that kind of stuff. In terms of sexuality, they determined that you could not have a bedroom scene in which two people were in the same bed. So even married couples were in twin beds, and every sex scene, you couldn't have a scene in a bedroom unless at least 1 foot was on the floor. So this kind of restricted a lot of things. So in those movies, if you wanted to have sexuality, you had to do all kinds of different language things, and it actually pushed the artists to be more creative because they couldn't be so explicit. But why? Because they were trying to appeal to everybody. And during the Great Depression, the movie industry was one of the most profitable industries in the United States, and in World War II it blossomed and became a world institution. Now, starting in the 50s, but taking off in the 60s, 70s to the present time, a new system has arisen. The old studios are gone. The names are the same, but they're not the same entity at all. And I won't get into why. It had to do with government regulations and so forth. Now the studios are just money hubs. You know, when you go to the movies, you say, John Frank film, a Miramax production of a, so, geez, what is all this? These are all the people who put the money in. So each studio puts in a little bit of money into each film. That way it cuts the risk. So if you have six or seven major investors, not everybody is putting all their money on one film. And the people who run it now, in the old days you had these studio chiefs who were mainly immigrants, who didn't have a great education, but they had a great sense of story. And they also knew their name was going to be on the film. And they are very, what my name's going on that film, so I want to see every single scene. The new guys are money boys the money moguls, the bean counters, whose name does not appear on the film, and all they're interested in is if it makes any money. And the most powerful people in Hollywood now are the stars and their agents who want films that'll get them an extra $1 million for the next film. And today, when they make a movie, they have decided that the people who go to the movies are between 13 years of age and 30 years of age. And they don't care about anybody else. If anybody else comes, fine. But they're aiming for the 13 to 30-year-olds. And the men are going to choose the film to go with, and they're going to drag in their girlfriends and wives and daughters. So there's a whole new way of looking at films. So now when you look at a film, it's slam, bang, boom, boom, because that's what the guys like. And then they'll have something in there for women. Now, different films, of course, a particular film may be different, but in general, that's the way they make films. And they know that in the old system, people went to the theater, because in the 30s and the 40s, if you went out at night, you probably went to the movies. And most people went to the movies very often. Today, only 25% of revenues comes from the theaters. Most of the revenues comes from videos. So they have a whole different orientation. So those are those two different Hollywoods. Okay, how does Hollywood affect our society? It can guide society, give society something new that it hasn't seen before, and push it in some direction. The artists want to do that. It can lag behind society because there are mediocrities and they know what sold last year. They know it was popular last year, so they do it again. So it's kind of lagging a little bit. Or they can be reflecting current society. And I think that's what most Hollywood films do today, is they reflect what's already in the society, but they take what they think is the cutting edge. So they know what 20-year-olds are thinking and doing, and they stick those in the movies. So they're not so much creating values as reflecting the values that already exist, but they then reinforce those values. And what you have today also is product placement. If you go to a 30s movie, a guy walks in, he says, "Give me a beer." Today, when they go to the movies, they say, "Give me a Bud," because Budweiser has invested in the movie, and now they have Budweiser. So the film is reinforcing consumerism, and so people wear clothing with the manufacturer's label on it and so forth. So this is another way that it reflects current trends. So I want to give some examples of guiding, lagging, and reflecting. And money can be made from the last two, but very rarely from the first. If you're trying to guide society into some new way of looking, generally, these films are not very popular and don't make a lot of money. The films that lag and reflect tend to make a lot of money, if they make money at all. The other thing you should know, in the old system, every film made money. It was designed so that every film would at least pay back its money, whereas today they make 10 films and they only want one of them. They're happy. They want them all to make money, but they are happy if only one of them makes money, because that's going to make so much money it'll pay for the other ones. And when they put them out there, if the film doesn't do so well, they just jerk it and let it die. So they don't care if 7 or 8 films die, as long as the other two make huge amounts of money. So this guiding, lagging, and reflecting, we can refer it to a film, we can refer it to a genre, or we can refer it to trends. So let's look at films that guide, and I'll start out with one of the most horrendous films ever made, Birth of a Nation. I don't know how many of you have seen it. You didn't see it when it came out, because it came out in 1916. Okay. I hope that you many of you saw when it first came out, or maybe. It was made by D.W. Griffith, and it was the cutting edge technology of its day. It had all the new special effects, which we now see the film and we don't understand how innovative it was. But the subject matter of Birth of a Nation was the Ku Klux Klan. And Griffith thought the Ku Klux Klan was the best thing that had ever happened. And if you see Birth of a Nation, almost every single historical fact is not only wrong, it's 100% wrong. He just turns everything completely around. So blacks aren't being oppressed by whites are being oppressed by blacks. The Northerners coming in are not idealists trying to reshape society. It's the Southern plantation owners who are the idealists, who really understand black people and love them. And the abolitionists who come in are just stupid, arrogant people when they're not outright crooks. The Union Army isn't protecting blacks. It's exploiting blacks, et cetera, et cetera. And who is going to save the South from this terrible thing? The Ku Klux Klan. And in this film, you have guys in the Ku Klux Klan who are the heroes. And it's a long story, which I won't get into. But basically, it's the white abolitionist's daughter finally is assaulted by a black mulatto, which is the word used. And she will be raped, and so will most of the women in this town, if these Ku Klux Klanners don't arrive in time and they get on their horses and you see them riding to the rescue. They're like the cavalry coming. And of course, they come in the end, and as soon as they arrive and start shooting, all the blacks run away. And the Northerners realize the Southerners were right. And in the final scene of the film, a Southern plantation male marries the abolitionist's daughter, who now realizes he was right all along. And there's another one where the Southern belle marries a Northerner who always understood that they were right. And they all go out and sit down by the waterside, and they look up in the sky, and believe it or not, Jesus Christ appears and blesses them. And they say, now the Civil War is over, the nation is reborn, we've had the birth of a new nation. Well, this sounds pretty silly. It was the biggest selling film of its time. Woodrow Wilson, who may have been a liberal in some things, was a racist, and he showed it in the White House, and he said this was a really good film. And the Ku Klux Klan revived in the South, partly due to this particular film. And they would show the film, and then they would hand out cards, and people would join the Ku Klux Klan. And from the 1910s up until almost the 1930s, when Roosevelt came in, the Klan was a very important political organization. That's the guidance that I don't particularly, I'm not too happy about that, but that is one particular film that actually changed American society. I can't think of a single progressive film that had such an impact on American society, but I can give you some attempts. During World War II, Roosevelt called in the Hollywood moguls, and he said, "We are now at war. And so I want you to make movies that will rally the nation to the war effort." And there are different ways of doing it. I'll give you two examples. One was, we got to do something about anti-Sovietism, so make us some pro-Soviet movies. And two, we got to do something against anti-foreignism, because in the 1920s, because of the Klan and so forth, there was a lot of anti-foreignism in the United States, attacks on the foreign-born. So Warner, Goldwyn, etc., all the various studios, each made one pro-Soviet film. The stupidest one is called Song of Russia, in which Robert Ryan goes to Russia as an American military advisor, and he meets a ballerina, who's of course beautiful, and they fall in love, and as they're having their champagne and ballets and so forth, he explains America to her, and she explains Soviet Union to him, and they both realize they've misunderstood each other, and that the cooperation really is possible. Kiss, kiss, final scene, happy ending. Then Lillian Hellman wrote a film called North Star Village, which is a strange movie, because the first half of it is kind of a musical, and the second half is a war movie. In the first half, you get to this Ukrainian village, you imagine the Ukrainians, and they're very happy. They just love being part of the Soviet Union, and the commune is working beautifully, and the children are going to school, and the music, and the health care is wonderful. In fact, there's this great doctor who happened to be from this village, who's left Moscow to come to be in the village because he realizes it's his humanitarian and socialist duty to provide medicine to the common people. So this great world scientist is the village doctor, and they dance wonderful Russian dances and eat wonderful food, and it's just a wonderful place to live. And then the Nazis attack halfway through the movie, and all these peasants and so forth slowly turn into resistance fighters. And so the film ends with the idea that the Russian resistance is a powerful resistance, and it's a good thing they're on our side, aren't they nice people? And then the most infamous of these films because those are all kind of, you know, Hollywood-type films. It's Mission to Moscow, in which an American ambassador goes to Moscow at the time of the Purge trials. And in the Purge trials, the old Bolsheviks are found to have been in cahoots with the Japanese and the Nazis, and they all confess. And the American ambassador says, oh yes, it's a good thing you caught those guys, because we know now it was all nonsense. And then he has a meeting with Stalin. And Stalin has a very nice, dignified man smoking a pipe, kind of Uncle Joe. And he explains how the Soviet Union is going to do this and that if only the United States would send some weapons and open a second front, et cetera, et cetera. And then the rest of the film is the guy comes back to the United States and he argues to the American Senate why we should send arms to the Soviet Union, and don't believe all these things you heard. They're much more democratic than you think, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a really boring film, actually. It really is. But it's so pro-Soviet, and it endorses the purge trials and so forth. Well, none of these films was a big hit, but every week when you went to the movies, something like this would come. So the public's mind begins to feel, well, the Russians aren't so bad. And then, of course, in the 1950s, they'll give you another set of movies. In fact, they took North Star Village, the same film, took off the dialogue, and put in a voiceover and made it into an anti-Soviet film. But that's a long story. So that's one way in which those films changed public opinion. Another interesting thing they did was what's called the platoon movie. People in America weren't so sure about one another, particularly the foreign-born. So if you look at a Hollywood movie of World War II, in the platoon, there'll be a southern cracker and a northern guy from Brooklyn, usually. You know, he talks funny. And there's a Swede, and there's a this and a that, and they're all uncomfortable with one another. They just don't quite like each other. But as the movie goes on, the platoon comes together and they realize that they're all Americans, you know, and the guy from Brooklyn realized, boy, that southern boy really knows how to shoot, you know, and he can show me how to shoot. And then the southern boy says, boy, guy from Brooklyn's really smart, you know. And so they come together and coalesce, and in the end, they're an American team. And they purposely made different movies with different ethnic groups. So in one movie, it was focused on Italians. Another one would be focused on Swedes. Now, I happen to know the Greek one. It's called Destination Tokyo. And Dane Clark plays the Greek. And nobody likes him. They're on this submarine, and this guy, he's always off by himself, and he's kind of he seems to be edgy, and they wonder, you know, is he a saboteur, you know? Who is this guy? And they finally confront him, the other guys, and he erupts, and he gives him a lecture about Athens and the cradle of democracy, and that his people have been fighting the Nazis in Greece now for so many years, and he just wants to be worthy of that, and he's concentrating on doing something against the Japanese, and so they elect that he can shoot the torpedo when they get to Tokyo. He gets to push the button that sends the torpedo into the Japanese fleet. So he then becomes part of the crew, and they all love him, and they realize he's really a nice guy after all. And in one movie, it's the Swede, in another movie, it's somebody else. So if you went to the movies week after week after week, and you saw these platoon movies, you sort of realized, well, we're all Americans, and it sort of ended the worst kind of anti-foreignism or anti-foreign-bornism, and the films are very clear about doing that consciously. And then, you know, otherwise, it's a regular story. The best of those is called A Walk in the Sun. And A Walk in the Sun, they even manage to get a black soldier into it. Paul Robeson sings. So you don't see him, but you hear him, and you know that's a black voice, so he kind of gets attached. And another platoon movie, the only other platoon movie that has a black in it is Sahara, a Humphrey Bogart movie in which they manage to get a black soldier into it, and the black soldier is very important, and he gets to kill the Nazi at a certain point in the film, so you really know he's a loyal American as well. Now, in the question of African Americans is interesting because Hollywood never took a lot of chances. Being pro-war is fine during the war, and being pro-Soviet is okay when the government's pro-Soviet, but what do you do with blacks? And in this sense, Hollywood has really taken a bad rap. There, some of the black nationalists a few years ago were saying, oh, you know, the moguls wouldn't let any blacks in and so forth. Actually, Hollywood has more had more integration and was more open to using African Americans than sports, than opera or the ballet. Now they had small roles, etc., but they were there. And in the 40s, particularly the communists, socialists, and other leftists who were in Hollywood try to get blacks into movies. And I've been told many interesting stories. I'll give you two. Bernard Gordon was writing a film, and he said, in the script, he said, a black taxi driver picks up person and so forth. And the producer said, how come he's a black taxi driver? He said, well, because there are black taxi drivers, and he's just going to pick them up and so forth, and just a chance to produce it. That could hurt sales in Mississippi. Take them out. There's another film called Body and Soul, which is a fight film, and there's a black champion, and he's going to fight a white contender, and there's a big scene where they all gather in the room and discuss the fight and so forth. The producers were looking at it and said, oh, can't do this, can't do this. And the guy said, what's wrong with the scene? He said, well, look. The guy looked at it, he said, what's wrong with the scene? He said, the black guy has a hat on, and nobody else is wearing a hat. We can't do that. That'll hurt sales in Mississippi. And he says, well, what am I supposed to do? And he says, well, you can give everybody a hat, or you can take his hat off. So that's where they were in the 1940s. In the 1950s, as the civil rights movement began to come along, Hollywood began slowly introducing black characters. It was actually, in some ways, in the vanguard of changing things. And what they would do at first is they would have these films where the black guy and the white guy were chained together. Remember that one? Tony Curtis and Fortier. They were chained together. They didn't like each other. You know, but since they were chained together, they had to work together, and by the end, they get to be friends. And then that continues going along, till today. You have the black and white cop buddy films in which they're equals. But they start off by the black guy doesn't understand the white guy, but now we've evolved to you don't have to do that. There's also the question of kissing and dancing. In 1948, if you did a film and you had a dancing, and it was supposed to be a regular place, you couldn't have a black couple dancing where the whites were dancing, because that will hurt sales in Mississippi. Finally, in the 50s, they put a black couple way in the back. So people are dancing, you see a black couple. Then the question was, could a white male and a black female have some kind of connection? And you can follow a whole sequence of films, like The Touch, The Look. You know, in this film, they're allowed to touch. In this film, they're allowed to look. And then The First Kiss. Now, the first kiss, interracial kiss, is half cannot be in continental United States, so they sent in the Bahamas or somewhere, you know, a little kind of not quite the U.S. And if that passed, you know, if that film did well, then they could move the next kiss can be in the United States until we finally have worked our way up to some kind of equality, not perfect, but getting there. So in that sense, Hollywood was reflecting and pushing forward that particular issue. And in that sense, Hollywood was ahead of the country on race. Not way ahead, but a little bit ahead. In terms of gays, in the 1930s, all gays were sissy boys. If you see any of those Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire movies, there's always a sissy boy prancing about, you know, and everybody knows he's gay. Nobody says he's gay, but you all know he's gay. But then in the 50s, you began having more serious gay characters. And Hollywood is very pro-gay, I would just put it that way, that of all the issues that exist, it's the one issue that they feel America's wrong on. So they continue to try and push forward positive gay characters. And in that sense, you can say they're leading the country forward. So these are guiding kind of films. Lagging films. Lagging films can be very popular. Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, in the 1930s, lived in some small town in the Midwest where everybody spoke English perfectly. They were all Protestants. There was no crime. And there were all these little, like, who's going to go to the senior prom? Is the bank going to give us a loan for $1,000 or $2,000? Very squeaky clean, very popular films, which had nothing to do with what America was really like. That America had already ceased to exist, but people thought it still existed, and so they would go to those movies and enjoy them. And we look at them now and we kind of giggle. In fact, if you show these to college students, that these are always good for chortling and laughing, and they say, boy, America was really stupid then. But even when they were making those films, they knew that they were out of date. And again, the Goldwyns and the Warner's, said, just do that because it's popular and it makes money. And they, if they got somebody with an accent, they said, get rid of your accent. And they put them in acting school to get rid of their accents. Whereas later on, accents would be sexy, and they would teach people who didn't have accents how to have accents. I don't know if you know Ida Lupino as an actress, but she's born in England, and she had to get rid of her British accent, and then she became the prototypical American woman and was shown over and over again as a very working class person with a very working class American accent, but she was British. They wouldn't allow her to continue to have an English accent. In the 50s, we had the Rock Hudson Doris Day movies, which were all about sex, except they never had it. You know, they were always back and forth and this and that. But in fact, in the 50s, that sexuality was already outmoded. But people would go to the movies and believe that that's what sexuality was all about in America. And those were extremely popular movies. And again, you look at them now, and it's really silly. And what's really silly, of course, is that movie in which Rock Hudson pretends to be gay in order to get the attention of the psychologist that, you know, he really was gay. So anyhow, cowboy movies. Cowboy movies always were lagging because, you know, the cowboy was always this white hats and black hats. In the more adventurous movies, he loved the saloon girl, the saloon girl was the one he really should marry, but luckily she always got shot in the end, and he married the school teacher. So hundreds of movies like that. And if you know the movies, as soon as it starts off, you say, oh, she's going to die, because you could not marry a fallen woman. That was one of the rules of Hollywood, was that if a woman had some sexual indiscretion, she had to suffer. So she could get cancer, she could get shot, she could fall down an elevator shaft, but she could not marry the hero. That's the one thing she couldn't do. So in a cowboy movie, you knew that an Indian would kill her, or a gambler, or somebody would get rid of her, but not until near the end. Not until near the end. And there was always the preacher's daughter, the school marm, the librarian, who was always around, and the guy would always end up with her, although he always felt he liked his horse a little bit more. And the cowboy movies have sort of died out. You don't see them anymore because it's just too silly, and they didn't figure out how to move forward with the cowboy movies. The other problem with the cowboy movies is the Indians were always just these terrible rascals, and as we sort of understand now that they weren't terrible rascals, they haven't figured out how to make a cowboy movie in which the Indians aren't rascals, and then they try to reverse it sometimes where they make the Indians great and the cowboys bad, and it doesn't quite work either. So they don't know what to do, so you don't see any cowboy movies. Gangster movies have changed, which we'll talk about. The gangster movies keep evolving. Musicals. You don't see musicals anymore for a number of reasons. One is they're too expensive to make, and only the Hollywood studios could make them, because the Hollywood studios had orchestras on salary. So if you work for MGM, they had their own orchestra. So their orchestra was working all the time, and since they were making musicals all the time, they could afford it. Now if you make a musical, you got to go hire an orchestra. And you got to hire them for 20 days or 30 days, and you got to pay a lot more. But the musical had its problems too. I'll give you two that are two really good musicals, and how they both came out in the 40s and the 50s. On the Town, the Frank Sinatra movie, Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra are in it, and it's the first movie in which you see New York City. Gene Kelly convinced the people at MGM to give him a camera, and he'll take the camera, because the camera's got light now, and he took it into New York City, and it's the first time you actually see the Brooklyn Bridge, and you actually see the Empire State Building, and you see Rockefeller Center as it really is. And it was quite sensational, and then they shot the rest of the film in the studio. But that's too expensive to do now for a musical, because it just to set up a street scene and do that just costs so much money. This innovation actually was a dead end for musicals. And if you see On the Town now, you realize when they were shooting that, a lot of the people in the scene weren't even actors. They just went up to the Empire State Building and started shooting. You see some woman, she kind of looks up, what the hell are they doing here? Because they're doing it fast. Whereas now you can't do that anymore, and the technical quality isn't so good, and people won't accept the technical quality. Singing in the Rain, which came out in the 50s, is probably one of the greatest musicals of all Hollywood creation. But it actually looks backward. And the best parts of it are vaudeville things and it's like they've taken the best of the past and they put it all into one movie, but it's also a dead end because you can't make Singing in the Rain 2 because you've used up all your good stuff. There's one sequence of Donald O'Connor where he dances for about 10 or 15 minutes. He does a routine where he does every single vaudeville routine that hundreds of people had figured out. He gives them all of them to you, and it's fantastic, but it's the end. I mean, there's nowhere to go from there because it's just summing it up. So those are kind of lagging. Today, a lot of the lagging stuff is actually on television. And think about this, ER, one of the most popular television shows ever. Do you know any hospital that has doctors like those in ER? It's a fantasy. It's a complete fantasy. It's lagging. It's like pretending that's what the hospital system is like. Also, Law and Order, in which you have only honest, dutiful, straight-laced cops. I mean, they may drink too much and so forth, but they're really decent guys. They wouldn't think of beating anybody up. They wouldn't think of framing anybody. And the prosecutors are wonderful. They know about the Constitution and so forth. So Law and Order and ER are like the old Hollywood movies that give you this never, never land where it's nice to believe that that's what the police department is like. It's nice to believe that there are doctors and hospitals in the emergency ward who actually say, oh, he's sick, I think I'll go and visit his mother and see how his mother is. Missing in action. In the 1930s through the 1950s, ethnics are missing. There are practically no ethnic characters in any films. And that is somebody who is from a European background where their European background is important. Oh, you may have an Italian restaurant where you go in there and the guy says, oh, here's some spaghetti, and walks away. But there's nothing about Italian culture. There's nothing about Polish culture. There isn't a single film about Greeks. Well, there's one beneath the 12-mile reef where they're sponge diving here in Tarpon Springs. But, I mean, these are all the exceptions. There are ethnic characters just don't exist because they wanted to have American characters because they were appealing to that mass audience. And that begins to change in the 50s in some films you may know, such as Marty. Marty is one of the first real ethnic films, and that Marty is a second generation Italian, and his mother is still alive, and there's this conflict between he wants to take care of her, but her head is in one place and his head's another place, and the brother has married out, you know, he's married to somebody who's Irish, and she doesn't want the mother-in-law living with them anymore, and there's this, like, it's your house, it's my house. Real problems that are solved rather happily, but it's one of the first times that ethnic characters begin to evolve. And ethnic characters basically have not been given much attention in Hollywood, even at the present time.